Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, April 14th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening, and Franklin Sanders, too. Tonight, Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders of the Money Changer. As a special treat, we've started to put together our transcript for what I'm calling, it's a special Soleri Report, Precious Metals, the Top 10 Dates in American History. We've done 6 of the 10. We're going to do the 7th tonight. And we're building the transcript, and we thought we'd share it with you along the way now that we've done 6 dates, and that way you can stay current and refresh your memory. It's the transcript of the 6 so far is posted at your control panel as the resource for this evening's event, and we're going to continue to update that 7, 8, 9, 10 until we have the full 10. Precious Metals, the Top 10 Dates in American History. It's all interviews of Franklin that we've done on the Soleri Report, and we really think it'll give you a very rich picture of the history of our economy, very useful, particularly once it's all done. So check it out, the Top 10 Dates in American History. You can get it at your control panel. Our theme tonight is freedom from collapse. I talked in the first quarter report last week a little bit about how collapse doesn't happen in the system collapsing all at once. If you talk to people who are very concerned about things like peak oil, they'll promote a scenario of collapse where everything collapses at once, and that's not the way collapse happens. I said in my first quarter report, collapse comes to Fukushima. What we've seen is whether it's Haiti or the globe, or Haiti or the Indonesia or Fukushima or different parts of the world, collapse comes, but it's sequential, and it's one place after another. And in fact, oftentimes it's a place that's being exploited by the system. So the system continues on and life goes on, whereas collapse happens to a household, to a sector, to a place, but not to everybody all at once. And I really wanted to mention that again tonight, because I want you to think of collapse as a scenario you use for planning. I think it's good to have a plan for the worst case, and very freeing to have a plan for the worst case. But we need to be free of the collapse scenario, because, in fact, the future is something that's built and created, and nobody builds future by planning for collapse. So you want to plan for a future, use collapse, be prepared for the worst case, but build a future, and in that sense, be free of collapse. Money and markets. The president's budget speech put taxes back on the table, and suddenly, it's very magical. You see this because you can tell a wave is coming. Suddenly, we have grassroots, what are supposed to be grassroots groups, jumping up and talking about taxes and the unfairness of the current tax structure, all meritorious things. But we also are seeing a tremendous number of articles flood out from journalists now that it's tax time on the number of corporations are paying very little or no taxes. I put some up on the blog, and I'm going to put more. Now the president, so we have this what looks like this groundswell for taxes. The president's talking about putting taxes back on the table. Be very wary of this. The danger is that we put taxes on the table, pass something that looks good. With it comes cuts in Social Security and health care. And after the pig goes through the snake, what really happens is the tax burden on the individuals are higher and the corporations are still pretty much skating. We're also seeing a very interesting development around Goldman Sachs. The Senate panel that interviewed Goldman Sachs when they were being investigated by the SEC slammed them in a new crisis report, Senator Levin, basically saying that Goldman Sachs lied, misled clients, manipulated markets, and is referring the matter to the Justice Department and the SEC. Now, I have a very big question mark about what's going on. This happens right after Buffett gets his money out, and Blankfein is clearly indicated to be on his way out. So with Buffett with his money out, Goldman, in a sense, is in play. And I think one of two things might be going on. One is we're coming into a presidential campaign. We have the New York Times now with a new article pointing out no one's really been indicted or prosecuted. Lots of sort of not very, very well written and well done, but not meritorious explanations of why that is You know, they're always saying, oh, it's very hard and very complicated. That's a whole bunch of yah-yah. In this instance, it's not hard and complicated at all, not where there's the political will to do it. But so you almost wonder, is Goldman being teed up to be the next scapegoat? Because somebody needs to be the bad guy. And if we're going to have a campaign where we show that we were really hard on the bankers and we really did, the system is meritorious and you can trust the system, somebody's going to have to be the scapegoat. So you almost wonder, coming into the presidential campaign, is Goldman Sachs being teed up to be the scapegoat now that Buffett has his money out? Another possibility, and I think is a greater possibility, is who's going to be the new leader, which faction's going to be in charge. And so there may be a competition going on for who's going to run Goldman, with Black Fine pulling out. And the fight, and you'll see this happen at a big corporate level, sometimes the fight will spill over into the Department of Justice and the SEC and these kind of bureaucracies, because in fact so much of the profits are determined by political methods that the fabric of the public-private sector gets integrated into the squabble. We see the credit default swaps on Goldman going up in price today. That's a real indication that there may be something serious happening. So it's fluid. It's something to watch. It could be important. But as you know, I track a lot about what happens with Goldman. American economy continues to struggle with the pincer movement of the slow burn, falling income. The pain on student loans is particularly ugly. I've been doing a lot of research in that area, as I mentioned last week. If anybody has recommendations for books or sources on student loans, I'm in a pretty big reading period now, and so I would welcome any recommendations you have. Food stamps up to 44 million, all-time high. Expect that to go up even more. Surprise, surprise, we have the IMF warning about ETFs in a way that makes me a little bit nervous. I've written an article with my attorney on why I don't trust the gold and silver ETFs, but many of the criticisms I make there apply to the other ETFs. The reason this article I took notice of, put it up on the blog, is it's the kind of warning you get coming into a regulatory shakeout or a market shakeout or both. So I think it's worth taking a look at and keeping an eye on, particularly if you're doing anything with ETFs. Fukushima, we continue to watch and try and discern how big the impact is going to be, both on the Japanese economy, the global economy, the American economy. There's still a lot more uncertainty than anything around that, but it could be a very, very dramatic impact. I have a lot of questions, so I'm going to be brief on money and markets. Our hero this week is, you're going to be surprised at this one, Jesse Ventura. I've been putting blogs up. Jesse Ventura has a new book out called 63 Documents. He's kind of, rather than talking about conspiracies, he's talking about documents. They're all government documents, including the document that authorized or changed the chain of command on response to planes that went off flight plan and which commander could shoot down a plane, et cetera, that was instituted by Donald Rumsfeld in June 2001 before 9/11. And, I have to give Ventura credit because as he goes on the book tours, and I put a couple of the videos up on the blog, the person questioning him will start off and try and say, well, you've documented 63 conspiracies. And he said, no, not conspiracies, documents. These are government documents. The book is 63 government documents. And it's amazing. It's very rare that a person gets very effective at sort of checkmating the conspiracy tagline. And Ventura's done an incredible job, and I think that the idea of publishing the documents is quite clever. Okay, so we have a lot of questions, and I want to handle them tonight. Some are precious metals, so I'll hold off until we talk with Franklin. I had been asked by one subscriber, very good question, how do we keep our local sheriff under the new Michigan Emergency Financial Managers Bill? They linked to the bill and said, this legislation gives the state the right to come in and replace our elected officials, including the local sheriff. So I promised that I was going to write Richard Mack and ask him about this. I did, and he wrote back. This is very funny. Catherine, I got your email and thought you ought to see this. The main answer to all this are sheriffs with some courage. We can beat around the bush and try and dissect everything till the cows come home. But the bottom line is, do we have sheriffs with some courage to stand for freedom? What he's essentially saying is, and I agree with it, is basically the law and constitutional law is on the right of the sheriff. The question is, are you willing to exercise it? Anyway, but he sent me a letter from Glenn E. Palmer, sheriff for Grant County in Oregon. I believe it's Oregon. And so I wanted to read it to you because this is an example of a sheriff exercising his authority. And it's written to a supervisor at the National Forest in John Day, Oregon, who's presumably a bureaucrat for the Forest Service. Ms. Raff, regarding the pending cooperative policing agreement between the U.S. Forest Service and the Grant County Sheriff, I'm advising you in writing that I will not be signing the agreement. I do not believe that it is in the best interest of the people I serve or the Grant County Sheriff's Office to continue with the agreement. There are several issues that I will bring to your attention at this point, but will not go into in detail. The issues include, but are not limited to, how U.S. Forest Service LEOs treated citizens of this county, an October and November of 2010 travel management plan, illegal road closures, grazing, logging, wood permits, prescribed burns, unemployment, and other socioeconomic issues this community faces today. There is a general mistrust of the federal government by the people of this county, state, and nation. You are aware that I had sent at least two requests to the U.S. Forest Service asking for information that pertains to where the U.S. Forest Service gets its constitutional authority to have law enforcement officers within Grant County. One response that I've received in writing is that their authority is given through the cooperative policing agreement that this agency has signed in the past. Upon asking for clarification and a second request, the response was that I needed to check with my district attorney. Neither response, in my opinion, is adequate. Under Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution, the federal government is limited in its powers and authority. Your jurisdiction, I see, is limited in nature to the federal building in John Day. Within the confines of Grant County, Oregon, the duties and responsibility of law enforcement will rest with the county sheriff and his designees. Now, what's he doing? Sincerely, Glenn E. Palmer, sheriff for Grant County. What he's doing is he's basically telling the federal government they do not have jurisdiction to enforce U.S. Forest laws or regulations without going through the sheriff in his county. And so Mac's point is very well taken. If we're going to exercise this law, it's really not, the state or the federal government can pass all the unconstitutional laws they want, but they can't take effect where there are sheriffs who will exercise their jurisdiction and citizenries that will back them. And as this becomes a more important economic issue, maybe it's going to happen. We'll see. Okay. Unnatural causes of the Japan earthquake. Be specific. You suggested the earthquake perhaps had other causes. Can you be very specific about what you mean? No, I can't. It's I'm persuaded that that we have the ability or we have weaponry that can help induce an earthquake. But, tying that to what happened in Japan is impossible. There's just not enough reasonable evidence. If you're interested in that topic, I've been researching and looking for somebody who I could get on the Soleri report to interview and continue to research it. But it's very, very difficult to get reliable information. What newspapers do you read? I currently read the Financial Times, but of course it's very pro-globalist. If you go to the Soleri Report blog, what you will see is a set of permanent links on the right-hand side towards the bottom, and I link in the different categories to all of the periodicals and sources, including subscription sources that I tend to use. And so I would encourage you to print through that list. And my richest source is not any particular newspaper or periodicals. It's just sort of an international network of people that, informally cooperate and share information with each other. And that, of course, includes the subscribers. I get great information and ideas coming in regularly from subscribers. Where is the list of food movies? I tried to find it on the site, but I couldn't. If you go to your control panel, you'll find our list of the top, it's 25 documentaries in one movie about food, and we did it last month. So if you just do a search for food in the control panel, you'll find it somewhere in the 2011, right next to the recordings, the MP3 file for that date. Could you talk about iodine usage, amount, safety, and other radioactivity levels and concerns. We did an interview several weeks ago with Dr. Laura Thompson to talk about radiation poisoning, and she talks about iodine and other sort of natural ways of responding to increase in radioactivity. We made a transcript. You can access that at your control panel, and I would really recommend it. Another question with Morgellons disease, which I referred to the interview with Dr. Gwen Scott and then the interviews of her that you can find on the internet. Okay, so now I'm going to hold off on the precious metals questions until after Franklin has had a chance to review the market. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Okay, Franklin. So this is the biggest challenge of the week. Can you explain what's happening in the precious metals market?
Not a chance. Not a chance. It was really exciting today because, the whole week's been exciting because it looked like we had a very significant sign of a top called a key reversal. And that came on Monday when gold broke into new high territory but closed lower for the day. And the key reversal has two parts. The first part is that break into new high territory and a lower close. And then the next day it has to be followed by another lower close. Well, gold gave us all that, every bit of that. And then today, it ran back up to the previous high, the high of the 8th of April, which is 1473 and some change, and it was 1471.70 today. So there it is, right back up at the top. That seems to cancel out that key reversal. Now, whether it's done it or not is a question because it could be a double top. So we have to see whether the gold market follows through tomorrow. If it follows through tomorrow with a higher close, then what I have expected to happen is happening, and that is we're gonna rally even farther yet. And if you look at targets, assuming that gold does not close but does not go below 1450 tomorrow, if you look at targets, there's an upside down head and shoulders in the gold market, which points to a target of $1,525 or so, which is actually only, $55 from where we are now.
So this could be a real breakout.
Oh, it is a real breakout.
It's
yeah.
a real breakout
yeah.
to the upside.
Yeah. The only thing is it has to follow through, or because as long as it doesn't close higher, you still have the possibility that you're seeing a double top, and that, you know, from there it'll drop quite a bit, because that's the danger of double tops. They seem to be, that second top seems to be very enthusiastic and very strong, and then all of a sudden the support and the steam just disappears. So we won't know until tomorrow, but it appears that the gold has canceled out the threat of a key reversal. And then here's what you have to add to it. Silver rose 3.4% today, 145 cents, 3.4%. I mean, that's a good rise for a month.
Right.
But one day is just astonishing. It ended the day at 41, didn't end the day, it closed COMEX at 41.66, and then in the aftermarket it was trading as high as 41.10, 41.20. So, I'm sorry, 42.10, 42.20. So, just incredibly strong. The gold-silver ratio made a new low, about 35 and a quarter. So just very, very strong. I went back and I looked at the moving averages, and maybe I ought to take a little detour, do a footnote here about the moving averages. A moving average is, if you're watching a market, you take 20 days and you average those prices, and that's the 20-day moving average. And then on the 21st day, you drop the oldest day and add the 21st day. And so the average moves along, but it's always the average of the last 20 days. And what that does is it sort of kicks out, it blocks the noise of the daily changes and gives you a smooth line, an average, that tells you which direction the market is moving. So when the market is headed, when a market is above its 20-day moving average, then it's headed up. When it's below its 20-day moving average, the momentum is down. And so it gives you, it's the 20-day moving average is the first warning sign of a change in trend. And it works the same way when a market trends down as when a market trends up, except when it's trending down, a market that trends down is generally below its 20-day moving average.
Now, you watch both 20 and 200.
Right. Those are the most important ones that I watch, although sometimes I look at the 300 and the 50 as well, because when you get a 200-300 crossover in the gold-silver ratio, it's very, very important. I mean, it's a very low-risk entry point. And anyway, what we're seeing is you can watch those moving averages, and when gold or silver is way up high and about to make a peak, then you see those moving averages are at extremes. So the distance between the 200-day or 20-day moving average and the actual silver or gold price will be very great in percentage terms. In other words, if I see the gold-silver ratio, if I see the 20-day moving average that stands at only 88% of the actual average, of the actual ratio, then that tells me that is extremely low. And there's a great likelihood that I am looking at the low in the gold-silver ratio, because that distance, I can go back and look for 10 years and see that 88% is the greatest distance that the ratio ever gets away from its moving average. Well, if I look at the gold 200-day moving average and 20-day moving average, and then the same thing for silver, they don't show that it's that overbought. Now, silver is more overbought than gold is, but gold is by no means, using those standards, gold is by no means overbought. So it could go up quite a bit more before it gets into territory where we'd look at it and say, ooh, that's a very extreme reading. And silver's more overbought than gold is, but there's still room for it to go up. It's not at the extremes. I mean, it's hard to believe, but in the peak in April of 2006, silver was more overbought versus its 200-day moving average than it is today. So there's a lot more room to move up. Of course, whenever you get a market that's as wild as both gold and silver have been, but especially the silver, you know that you're somewhere near some kind of peak, because markets don't gain 3.5% a day. You know, I mean, that they just don't do that very often. So you know that you're seeing extreme readings. And so I look around, I raise up my hand, and I look around, and I say, well, what other signs are there? Are there any more signposts that might give me an idea where we are? And one of those is seasonality. Gold simply, neither silver nor gold make peaks in June, July, or August. It's just, it's not seen. The yearly low is usually, and certainly almost always, a period of weakness occurs between the 1st of June and the end of July, almost always. Late in August is frequently a time when a rally will start, and peaks, especially cyclical peaks, tend to fall in the first half of the year, but especially in February, March, April, May, and almost always by the end, by the middle of May. So what does that mean? Well, we're sitting here at the middle of April. That means that we have maybe 30 more days to run, maybe 45 more days, pushing it into the first week of June. But the seasonality, the pattern of seasonality, says that there really isn't probably much more than a month, month and a half to run on this advance. However, a month or a month and a half could take us to $1,600 in gold.
Right. If gold is broken out to the upside, then 45 days, a lot can happen in 45 days.
Oh, goodness, yeah. But I think you're going to see a minimum of 1525, unless tomorrow you see gold close below 1550 or 1450 or 1440, you're going to see much higher prices over the next 30 days.
Okay, so that's what we need to watch tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
What about silver? If 1450 gets us back?
Well, with silver, silver really needs to stay over, silver needs to stay over $39, $39.50. As long as it stays above $39.50, it's okay. It's just really volatile right now. And if you look at the chart, you can see this straight-up curve. And you can go to www.stockcharts.com, and you can use the symbols. Go to select create a sharp chart, and you can use the symbols $silver and $gold to get those charts up. And when you do, what you'll see is that the recent movement in silver has been almost straight up, and the recent movement in gold has been somewhat the same. And whenever you see a straight-up move like that, a hyperbolic move, you know that you're coming to the point where the market needs to take a rest. But it's very, very difficult to predict that. I mean, silver right now is technically in an up move that is almost not predictable, at least not predictable for me. And there are a lot of experts who say you just can't make a target out of this kind of move because it's so strong, the impulse is so great to move higher that you can't really tell what will happen. So,
see, one of the problems I have with silver, and one of the reasons why I've been joining you and recommending the silver to gold swaps, is if you look at the crowd that's arguing for a higher silver price,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's more shrillness and more sort of COINTELPRO activities going on than I'm used to seeing in the precious metals market. And so it makes me, you know, when a market depends on that kind of behavior to go up,
yes,
it makes me very nervous because you're not on fundamentals.
Well, you don't even have to bring those people into the picture, although, I don't disagree with you. But whenever you get a market that's going straight up, you have to pause and catch your breath and say, you know, it's time for me to cover myself here. And the good thing about playing the gold-silver ratio, that is swapping gold for silver, silver for gold, is that what we can do is we can capture profits in one metal in the other metal.
Right.
And so if we trade into silver now, let's say we bought silver at 70 to 1, when an ounce of gold costs 70 ounces of silver. Well, today, an ounce of gold costs 35 ounces of silver. So we get 2 ounces of gold for our silver instead of 1 ounce of gold for our silver. And now it's going to turn around and it goes back up to somewhere between 46 and 56, maybe higher than that. And so we add another maybe roughly 30%, 20% anyway, to the amount of silver that we have. And what we're doing is we're capturing those profits in terms of ounces and stashing them away. And clearly, you know, silver's the more manic of these two right now. And I just feel comfortable. I feel a lot more comfortable taking some of those profits and by converting the silver into gold. And then I can wait. I can be very patient, waiting while silver drops faster than gold. And I know that I'm going to get the opportunity to go back into silver and increase the number of ounces that I have.
Well, I also think there's another consideration, which is, and part of it was, you know, the thing that really spoke to me was what happened in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you know, right now you have the G7 central banks pumping, pumping, pumping. So we've basically got a global QE3 going. And the news from Fukushima has not been sufficiently negative to really cause, either sort of another 2008, but it could. In other words, we're dealing with a lot more risk. Last week in the first quarter wrap-up, I said there were three things that if they continued and combined could put us in real trouble. One was a budget shutdown, one was Libya, and one was Fukushima. And it was very interesting. I said that on Thursday night. By Monday morning, Gaddafi was saying he'd accept peacekeepers. the president brokered a deal on the budget shutdown, and the Japanese were putting out a lot more press releases saying Fukushima was under control. And so it was literally as though the top guy said, hey, get everything back in their sub, you know, their watertight compartments here, because this is dangerous. So, but I think that danger is still with us. And in those scenarios, gold is the ultimate safe haven. And if we get another 2008 kind of correction, it's going to correct the least.
Well, go back to 2008. The ratio went from 40, a little over 47 in March of 2008 at the peak in the peak move in silver and gold, and from there it reached 84.326 on the 17th of October. Well, in other words, it lost something close to half of, silver lost half of its value against gold from March to October. So if you had been in gold, even though the gold took a huge whack too, the gold lost 30% against dollars. It lost 30% against dollars, but it gained nearly 100% against silver.
Yeah.
So what you can do, you know, you can use that leverage to your advantage, and you can afford to be patient. You can afford to, you know, you can afford to watch it carefully.
The I wanted to just turn and talk a little bit about the dollar mm-hmm. and the extent to which that's dovetailing with gold. I showed you a chart tonight,
mm-hmm.
And I talked about it last week. The dollar share of official global foreign exchange reserves
mm-hmm.
has dropped from 71.5% in 2001 to 61.3% in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
We see more headlines today, the Chinese making loans to banks around the world so that they can trade outside the dollar for foreign transactions. And then the other one, let me read from Kiplinger. Though U.S. exports continue to grow, rising 9% this year following a 12% gain in 2010, the nation's share of global trade is waning, claiming a thinner slice of an expanding pie. In 2000, 35% of world imports and exports originated or landed in the U.S. This year's share, about 11%. So there's no doubt about it. The dollar's losing market share, and the U.S. is losing market share.
But Catherine, I have to say that because we know that currency exchange rates are manipulated.
Really?
Well, I mean, we know that.
Yeah.
They meet, the heads of the central banks meet once a month in at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel and have supper together, and we can be pretty sure they don't talk about the Swiss cheese. So what, you know, they manipulate those prices. So that's the reason why I'm convinced that in the Bush administration, that there was a decision made that the dollar was going to be depreciated. Now,
yeah.
Is there a long? Are they trying to cure the balance of payments problem that way, or is there some bigger game on the table? And that bigger game is we're going to gut the dollar, like we gutted the U.S. economy with Bretton Woods and General Court on trade and tariffs. We're going to gut the dollar, and that'll give us an excuse for instituting, you know, a one world currency, which is definitely what they've wanted for years and years. I mean, since the 1940s, that's been on the table.
Right. I think it's very important to not underestimate how much money they can make if they're at 61.3, going to 51.3 and 41.3. There's a lot more to wring from this system. So, and there's a lot, you know, and there are a lot of pump and dumps on the way, including in the gold and silver market, which is what makes me so nervous about this run-up coming into the summer.
Right. Well, by the way, that you know, there's a target in the dollar that you could target the dollar at 40 to 1, at 40 on the dollar index, the U.S. dollar index. So that's another 35 points from here. That's a huge.
That's a big drop.
Oh gosh, it's 50% move from here. So. You know, I don't know why they're doing it, but I don't believe that that the market is merely forcing it on them by repudiating dollars. That's part of what's going on. But if they wanted to fight that, they'd call up their buddies. You know, Ben Bernanke would call up his buddies at the European Central Bank and the Japanese Central Bank and say, hey, the dollar's fallen too far, let's get it back up, and they'd do it. Just that simple.
Right.
So what you're seeing on the dollar chart is the signature of intent and purpose.
Right. I agree. Okay, we have a really good question, and I'm going to – it's written by somebody who's not American, so it's written for Europe, but I'm going to change the names to protect the innocent. Dear Catherine, my family and I hold an account at Very Big Bank. We have been shifting our portfolio to precious metals in the last several years and now hold a large position in mostly unallocated gold. I have been responsible for this move, partly after reading and listening to your wonderful advice, but now I wish I could convince my family to move to a safer, allocated physical account at a smaller, more reliable bank or depository, which they feel is unnecessary. Please, what is your recommendation? So I have many, many things to say on this, Franklin, but why don't I start with you?
My opinion has been since the 1990s that one of the accelerators of this bull market would be the announcement that some large depository of silver or gold has defaulted. And that you're going to see that before the end of this bull market. Now, does that mean some COMEX warehouse? Does that mean the ETFs? Does that mean someone else who issues certificates or claims to have gold or silver on deposit? I don't know who it will be, but it will be somebody, because they've played this game too long. They played this game where they sell gold and silver, claim to have it in storage, and they actually do not have it. And I know that happens because it happens in my little corner of the world. I can't tell you how many times the last 30 years I've come into work and there was XYZ company that was advertised that they stored gold and silver, and it's a lot easier to buy it that way, et cetera, et cetera. And they'd be blowing and going like a house of fire for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and then all of a sudden one morning you come to work and they've gone belly up, and all the customers' money has gone. And they, you know, the most hilarious one was the Kruger Inn Corporation down in Florida. Back in the early 80s, they advertised that they would sell Kruger Inns for spot. That is the spot gold price. Well, that was a pretty good deal, since at wholesale at the time they were 3.25%, 3.5%, and at retail that meant they were 6 or 7, 8%. So all these people piled in there to buy them from the Kruger Inn, buy coins from the Kruger Inn Corporation. The only catch was they didn't deliver any of them. They quote stored all of them, and they ran full page ads in the Wall Street Journal with pictures of their building, their headquarters, and at the top it had a sign the size of two stories that said Kruger Inn Corporation. Well, here's the problem. It turned out that the Kruger Inn sign had been airbrushed onto the picture. And then they finally went belly up, and the authorities went in there to see what they actually had. They opened their safe, of which pictures had been run in newspapers and so forth with bars of silver and gold in there. And it turned out that they were wooden bars painted silver and painted gold. Now, that sounds it sounds silly, but that's what's happened. And it, just because, you know, that was a company in Florida, just because they don't have a Swiss name, they're not in Basel or Zurich or New York, doesn't mean it can't happen to those people.
Right.
Or won't
if you add up all the unallocated accounts at all the banks and all the various different players, you know, there's every indication that the amount of actual gold and the amount of gold that people think they hold in those institutions is a very different number.
Right.
So the leverage in the unallocated system appears to be extraordinary. Now, as long as we're in a slow burn and there's a fair degree of liquidity and government is backing up that liquidity, I mean, it's interesting. I know people who maintain, in this kind of situation, they maintain a certain amount in allocated, and that's the amount that they don't want to be free to trade at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And they hold other positions in allocated because they want those positions to be highly liquid. But they understand in 2008 kind of scenario, they could lose them. So you want to, I think you want to divide up your allocated and unallocated. You know, you only want to keep an unallocated what you need to be highly liquid and what you're prepared to lose.
Well, exactly. And, you know, this is not something new. This is, maybe somebody else has called it this, but I think of it as the banker's temptation. And this is what the goldsmith learned back in the 17th century, that when people put money on deposit with you, only a very small percentage, less than 5%, ever comes to pick it up. In fact, 5% coming to pick it up is a run on the bank. And so anybody that acts as a depository, they see that with their own eyes very shortly. And so they know that they don't have to keep it all there because people are not going to come and ask to take delivery on it.
Now, it's interesting. I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to move unallocated accounts to allocated accounts in this country. And my attorney and I just published a big article. You can link to it from the article section on our website or find it at the blog. It starts off with tax issues, and it's by Carolyn Betts and myself. And we go into how to swap from an unallocated account to an allocated account. And in the United States, if you're a United States citizen, how to avoid taxes. So I really encourage you to read that article and use that to give to your CPA if you find yourself wanting to do it in this country, because it's important to make sure that you don't trigger a tax event if you can avoid it. So, I just have to underscore that I can't speak to the taxes for a lot of the jurisdictions who might consider this. So it's very important before you do that. The other thing you need to know is typically, depending on where you are, there is a fabrication charge. So if you're going to say, okay, I want, in some unallocated pools, you have the right to take gold, delivery of gold. In others, you don't. You literally have to sell the pool and then turn around and buy bars. Normally, you can just pay a fabrication charge. But if you look at the fabrication charge, sometimes, occasionally, there's an exit fee and then transportation costs, other things. It can be expensive. So for someone who can't conceive that an unallocated account at a major bank is not trustworthy, you know, they struggle with, why are we going to spend all this money? Now, you should have had quite a run-up in your precious metals, so hopefully that will help take this thing out of it, and hopefully you can do it on a non-taxable basis. But if you're an American citizen considering this, I really encourage you to read that article and share it with your tax preparer before you do anything. So it was prepared for that in mind. Okay, well, Franklin, let me just mention one other question. We had a wonderful question on the Zurich Canton Bank and the possibility of buying that ETF through a brokerage company. We've gotten so many different answers from different brokerage companies. It's amazing, Franklin. None of the brokerage companies really understand the law. It's pretty scary because it's gotten that complicated. I've now commissioned someone to really research it and write an article, so we're working on that. So hold on. The answer is coming. Before we continue with some of the things we want to cover today, Franklin, I just want to bring up and do my movie review now and then bring it back to the money laundering and tax laws related to precious metals. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, let's go to the movies. Our movie this week was The Listening. It's a movie that never became very popular, and I can't fault the audience for not embracing it. It's really not great entertainment. It's the fictional account of a NSA operative, very high level in the echelon system at NSA, which, of course, NSA is an actual intelligence agency, and the echelon system is an actual system used by the sort of Anglo-American Alliance intelligence agencies to listen to everything all the time. So we're talking about a global satellite network and enormous amounts of telecommunications and digital intelligence and surveillance that has become an integral part of economic warfare and sort of political control on planet Earth. And so it's interesting if you've never understood the echelon system or been introduced to it. It's very useful in helping you understand echelon. One of the reasons I wanted to watch it was there is a portion of it that really describes two phenomena. One is the extent to which these agencies have been taken over, if you will, by corporate and defense contractors. In the movie, the tension is between the NSA bureaucrats and a corporate contractor who's got new technology that allows Echelon to listen to people through their cell phone or their landline, even when it's turned off. They can listen within the house or the car or wherever the person is, even if the phone's turned off, even if the conversation is not on the phone. and they can also see. And so the corporation has developed this technology. Now, this movie was made in Italy right after the huge brouhaha in the early 2000s. It was discovered that Echelon was listening into the Pope's conversations and all sorts of high-level people. One of the things the movie focuses on is the extent to which this intelligence is then taken by NSA and given to private corporations, and it makes an enormous difference in their ability to compete and command market share and profits. And they don't mention banks or the financial world, but needless to say, it's the ultimate insider trading trading system, particularly when you're doing you have the kind of software and technology that that Wall Street has. And so it raises some very, very deep questions. And there's a wonderful scene at the end when one of people is arguing with the protagonist, and he says, "This is an issue for governments," and the now former NSA operative says, "Governments? What governments? There are no governments. These are corporations out of control." And it's a wonderful, you really get an intuitive sense for the extent to which there really are no sovereign governments anymore, and the extent to which technology and contractors within the government have completely sort of hijacked what most people think of are sovereign governments. Now, let me explain why I wanted to discuss this in the middle of our discussion with Franklin about precious metals. You will often hear Franklin say, he's got his 10 laws of buying gold and silver, and you'll often hear me say, never, ever, ever, ever break the law. And one of the reasons I wanted you to watch this movie, if you can get it, it's not at Netflix, it's hard to find. I bought it at Amazon, so you can get it online. And in fact, there are some pirated copies online, so you might be able to watch it online. But one of the reasons is that sometimes I'll talk with people and they say, "Well, you know, I bought those coins for cash, so I don't have to pay taxes on them when I sell them." And that presumes, you know, they presume that the phone conversation is private and that their lives are private, and they don't begin to understand the invasiveness of the technology that we're dealing with. And so I thought this movie would be very helpful for you to understand that there really is no privacy, and it is very important when you think about your paperwork and your compliance with the laws that you understand that, including the money laundering laws on precious metals, which I'm going to ask Franklin about in a second. The other thing I wanted to bring up was oftentimes I'll hear someone say, "Well, why would they do that? Why would a congressman or senator agree to go along with that?" Well, there's something called control files, and at some point I'd love to do a Solari report just on control files. But if you rise to a certain level as a politician or a government official or whatever, you have a file, and in that file is basically dirty pictures. We all remember the story, or many of us remember the story of J. Edgar Hoover and his love for having pictures of people in sexually compromising positions. But with a tool like Echelon and this kind of super surveillance, it's remarkably easy to build a file of dirty pictures and dirty stories and dirty transcripts on someone. You get enough of them in a file, and you basically have a control file on that person. They have to do whatever you tell them to do for cheap, and that's part of the game of economic warfare. And so I think this movie will help you both understand the extent to which there really is no privacy anymore, and the importance of your organizing your actions and regulatory compliance with that assumption in mind, and understand that you're dealing in a world where many, many people, particularly at high levels of business and government, have control files. So with that, Franklin, could you just, I got several questions over the last week about money laundering laws related to purchasing and transacting with coins, and I would love it if you would just review for us what those are.
I'd love it if I just stopped getting those phone calls from people who call me up and say, "I got $80,000 I want to spend on gold." "Oh, really? You do? Yeah, cash. I want to come pick it up at your place." And, yeah, I mean, you can imagine what kind of response comes out of that. Basically, what we're talking about are cash reporting laws. And it doesn't matter. The crime occurs when you deposit it in the bank. So if you come to me and you pay me $11,000 in cash, And the law says I'm supposed to report that if any one person gives me more than $10,000 in cash, more than $10,000 in cash in any calendar year. And I don't report that, but I do deposit it in the bank. That's the crime right there.
Right.
And it's just, I don't know I don't know how people's minds work, because I would not go to them and say, hey, how about committing grand larceny with me? And when you do that, I promise I won't tell anybody, and I don't even know them. What they don't understand is this is a crime that carries a number of years. I don't even know what the jail time is, but it's forfeiture of the currency. It's a fine. It's jail time, all this sort of stuff. Why would I do that for them so that they could avoid? I mean, even if I were inclined to commit a crime, I would probably be more inclined to commit it for myself and my own benefit rather than theirs.
Here's the thing. As soon as you commit a crime with a person, mm-hmm. you give them a control file over
it. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and here's the silly thing about it. I don't care. I'm not doing anything wrong, and I'm the government doesn't care whether you've got gold or silver or not. They just don't care. I understand that all of these companies out there have made a career of selling expensive, overpriced numismatic coins by scaring people with the specter of confiscation. And the truth is, you have a greater chance of being abducted by aliens from the planet Zambodia tonight than you do of having your gold confiscated, because this is not 1934 and the whole system is different. But the deal is, if you do business with more than $10,000 in cash, a currency transaction report is supposed to be filed, and that goes to the IRS, and they put them in a big room somewhere in Detroit. So that's the reason why we don't do that, and we try to explain to people, look, it's not worth it to you. You're trying to escape something that's not a problem, and you're breaking the law to do it. So don't do that. But this would be the same thing if you went down to the used car dealer and he had a car cost $15,000. You gave him $15,000 cash, and he didn't report it. When he goes to deposit it in the bank, then he's in the same kind of problem.
Right.
So I just don't recommend you do that. The other thing is, I've had people tell me that coin dealers have told them that they don't have to report gains on numismatic coins, and that's just silly. I can't believe that people are gullible enough to believe that. But nonetheless, that is reported to me continually. Here's the thing. I don't mind fighting the government on principle. If you just decide you're not going to pay income tax because there's no law that makes anybody liable, that's one thing. But I'm not going to argue with them about money.
Right.
And if you got a 50% gain and you got to pay them, 15%, or even if it's 28%, just pay them. It's not, unless you want to concentrate all your life on fighting with the government, it's just not worth it.
Right.
And besides that, I don't know whether I'm not so sure I'm honest, but I am simple-minded. And it's harder for me to keep up with lies than it is to keep up with the truth. I can pretty well remember the truth. I can't remember a bunch of lies.
Right. And
so it's just not worth doing.
Okay, a couple of quick questions, and then I want to go on to 1935. Interesting question that just came in on the website. The purpose of looting is to get loot, and there's not much point to rigging the system if your loot quickly vaporizes. My question is, where have the looters of the financial system stashed their loot?
Well, you're asking me.
I absolutely have a clear opinion on this, but I'll ask you first.
Well, no, go ahead. I mean,
okay.
They're always fading the public.
This is a pendulum, and it swings back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So pump and dump. And so you want to sell on the top of the pump, and then you want to buy at the bottom of the dump. So the first thing they've done is, they suppressed the gold price, bubbled the dollar, and shifted all their money into emerging markets where they were imploding those markets as they moved in. But part of that was they were printing paper and buying real things. So they've accumulated enormous positions in oil, in precious metals, in land, et cetera. And so, you know, literally they've been buying real things as they've been pumping the dollar. So a lot of their loot is stashed in the ownership of real things. But I also think a lot of it is stashed. I mean, someone says to me, you know, aren't you worried about Switzerland, or aren't you worried about Dubai, or aren't you worried about Singapore? And the answer is no, because the pirates have certain places they're counting on. And they can't compromise those places without compromising their own loot.
Yeah, London is another one.
Right. So, well, London, they have sort of an insider-outsider thing. It makes me a little bit more nervous than Switzerland. So, but you're right. There's certain places that the pirates depend on to protect their loot. And I think, you know, I think those places are off limits. Another question, what is your forecast for extending QE2 to QE3? If QE3 is delayed, do you believe this will reduce liquidity and cause a deflationary period? If yes, any prediction on a timetable? What effect will it have on precious metals? I'll just go first. I think that the G7 banks have QE3 underway now, so I don't think it's delayed. I think it's here. Now, the question is when, you know, how long will that last? We certainly are going to have an interesting period with this summer. QE2 ends. We now have, Franklin and I were discussing at dinner, we now have the U.S. mortgage market 95% government, federal government guaranteed. That's incredible. So this summer is going to be a real crunch period. I think the Federal Reserve is going to do everything they can to keep this out of a deflation, and their challenge is going to be, as Franklin, as you said earlier, if other people are raising interest rates, they're going to get cornered. Where do they go?
Well, like, if the European Central Bank raises interest rates, the fact is interest rates are the primary determinant of relative currency exchange rates. So they can't stretch that too far. If they do stretch it too far, then the expectation of the dollar depreciating plus a lower interest rate could really drive the dollar down very, very fast. Anyway, all of the, you know, Steve Saville says something that's very, very pithy and sensible to me, and that is, a central bank does not manage inflation. A central bank always inflates. What they manage is inflation expectations. They manage inflation expectations. So their job is kind of like the beaters on a safari. You know, their job is to keep the quarry going in the right direction, and that's exactly what they do. So if the public becomes concerned about inflation, then they'll start talking about a deflation scare, and that's just that's just the way they are. That's what their job is. That's what they do, is manage inflation expectations. So they have no choice but to inflate. I'm assuming that you understand that. They must inflate because the entire system is set up to inflate, and the system will die. It will seize up if they stop inflating. 50% of the, this was the thing about the government shutdown that I found bogus personally. 50% of the people in this country take their income from federal and state spending, state and local spending, government spending. What are they going to do? Are they going to just stop spending? They're going to stop sending out the pension checks and the food stamps and all the rest of them? No,
I don't think so.
Can't do that. No, I mean there's a lot of posturing going on here, but this latest business about the budget shutdown, it's like somebody who's spending $5,000 a month saying, "Wow, I just woke up to this. I've got to clean up my act. I'm going to stop buying chewing gum." You know, I mean, that's the only difference that they make.
Before we start on the Supreme Court, I just warn everybody, we're going to go over a little bit tonight. Wonderful subscriber from Australia asking to repeat the name of the metal site to check charts for silver. Wasn't it stockcharts.com you were mentioning?
It is stockcharts.com.
Yeah, stockcharts.com for the moving average. Okay, Franklin, the next date in the top 10 dates in American history for precious metals, 1935, a year that will also go down in infamy.
Well, this is the year that they put the icing on the cake of the 1933 gold seizure.
This is ugly. Get ready.
And it actually happened in 1934. 34 and 35, but this is when the Supreme Court showed its true colors. The seizure occasioned a number of lawsuits. I mean, you know, that ought to be obvious.
That's the 33 confiscation.
Right, the 1933 gold confiscation, because what happened was most of the gold that they confiscated was gold that was stored in banks. But it also involved the fact that involved the lawsuits about government bonds, because there had been some government bonds that had been guaranteed payable. They were payable by specification in gold coin, and the same thing was true for private corporate bonds, primarily railroad bonds. So there were two different groups of cases that worked their way up to the Supreme Court toward the end of 1934. There were four cases, and actually they were, one of them was combined. One of them was suits over the payment of private bonds that were payable in gold. Then there was another suit over U.S. gold certificates, and then there was a third suit, Perry, about U.S. government gold bonds. Now, here's the thing that's interesting about all four of these lawsuits. The litigants all conceded the validity of the 1933 gold seizure. The only controversy that they brought up was that they should have been paid more in compensation for the gold that they lost. That was the only issue. And every one of them made a big deal out of that in the briefs that they filed. And the Supreme Court made a peculiar decision. They said, well, because the gold was seized, you couldn't really have had the gold to sell it in Europe at the higher price. And, of course, that's a little bit like a snake eating its tail. But that was what the reasoning was. And so the only compensation that the government was liable to give was whatever the government decided it wanted to give. And then there was, at the same time, another series of cases, another set of cases that was also moving up through the system. And the difference was that the claimant here, a New York lawyer named Frederick C. Campbell, was challenging the constitutionality and legality of the gold seizure. And so Campbell had $200,000 worth of gold bullion stored with Chase National Bank of the City of New York. And when the government seized the gold, he did not file a return reporting that he owned the gold, which supposedly was required. On the other hand, Chase blew the whistle on him, reported the gold to the IRS, and then turned over the gold to the IRS. So Campbell really got his back up, and he sued Chase for the return of the gold. Then he sued the U.S. attorney, a fellow named Medalli, and the government, and I would not doubt that it was in part in retaliation for him filing these lawsuits, they indicted him on two counts of not reporting this gold. So the government lost, they won on one count, they lost on the other count, and all these three cases were working their way up at the same time, and Campbell filed three petitions for certiorari with the Supreme Court. A petition for certiorari. Certiorari is a petition to get the court to take the case and hear it, because the court is not required to take cases. They meet and decide which cases they're going to take. So Campbell has these three cases. Well, the government, the silly U.S. government, filed an appeal on the count he had been acquitted on, and they took up an appeal, which they could do at the time. They can't do that anymore, on this count that they had lost. And then they developed cold feet. So they filed a motion to withdraw the appeal, and they never bothered to inform Campbell. He found out about it reading it in the newspaper the same day the Supreme Court heard the motion on the heard the motion, and they granted the motion. So what happened was then Campbell still has these other two lawsuits and petitions for certiorari in front of the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court meets on the 8th day of October 1934, now they were meeting to decide which cases they were going to take. And all of these cases were on the table in front of them. Both the cases where the claimants did not controvert the constitutionality of the seizure, and cases, and Campbell's cases, who did object to the seizure as illegal. And here's what they did. They rejected all of Campbell's appeals, and they accepted for hearing all of the other appeals, which means they dodged the issue of the validity of and constitutionality of the gold seizure. And so that way they don't have to make any kind of ruling on the constitutionality of the seizure.
All they have to do is negotiate price.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, here's the odd thing now. It gets stinkier still. In the gold clause cases that were accepted and where opinions were written, there were four dissenters. And these four dissenters waxed full of moral outrage about what an awful thing had been done in the seizure and how it was the end of the country and immoral and all this other stuff, all right? But it only took four votes to accept a case for hearing. So these same four people on the 8th of October, 1934, met and refused to take Campbell's cases, which addressed that very question. It was a fix.
Right.
The whole thing was a fix to dodge the entire issue. And so what they did was they ex post facto, you know, after the fact, justified the seizure and made it impossible by this lying judicial justification. They made it impossible for anybody to get justice in the face of Roosevelt's theft.
Yeah, they couldn't question the confiscation and they couldn't question the price.
Right.
I feel terrible for Mr. Campbell, but he's not alone. Do you know how many Americans have lost money thinking that Chase and the government are separate institutions? Franklin, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure. We'll get the transcript in this and we'll have it up next month. Do you know what the next top 10, do you know what number 8 is going to be?
Well, number 8 will be, we're going to talk about the repudiation of silver certificates that happened from 1967 to 68. We'll talk about that, how the government reneged on redeeming silver certificates for
the
silver.
The government reneged?
Oh, I know it's hard to believe. I know. It's one of those very rare events in history.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for our precious metals market report tonight. Coming up April 21st, Blake Leavitt at Leavitt, backed by popular demand, beware the smart grid. We're going to go into the smart grid, what it is, how it works, what the challenges are, and sort of what the state of play is and getting them implemented, what you do if they're trying to implement one on you. May 7th, National Security with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. I'm going to ask Colonel Wilkerson to literally walk us in, sit us down into the position of the National Security Advisor or somebody leading the administration and say, what are the national security issues before us and why, and see if we can't integrate those with what we've been talking about in terms of the dollar and economics. And then on May 14th, back with Franklin for more precious metals. So until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.